I am Bob Denny, and I am President and CEO of the Renewable Fuels Association. I'd like to thank you all for joining us today. With me as well is Jeff Cooper, the Senior Vice President of the Association. Protecting the Monopoly, How Big Oil Blocks the Sale of Renewable Fuel. With this report, we wanted to shine a little light on a narrative coming from the oil companies these days, that the U.S. market can't possibly absorb more than 10% ethanol. The consumers don't want it and won't buy higher-level ethanol blends. And, of course, my personal favorite, that because the major oil companies have disinvested from their downstream blending operation, they don't have any control over the infrastructure or what is sold in any case. All that is just rubbish. And it's a shame that EPA has bought into much of that in trying to determine what to do for the 2014 RVO, the RFS, and beyond. But here are the facts. There is a market for higher ethanol blends. The market can absorb more. Big oil companies simply won't allow it. Consider this. There are more than 15 million flex-fuel vehicles on the road today that could use E85. The EPA has authorized E15 for a bit more than 80% of the market, all 2001 and newer vehicles. And if you're concerned about warranties for E15, well, 13% of the vehicle fleet this year and more than 17% of the vehicle fleet next year will be fully warrantied for E15. That's the market the big oil says doesn't exist. But they only want to, there's only the infrastructure for 0.6% of the stations that the five major oil companies own that offer E15 or E85. Compare that to other markets. About 17% of the vehicle fleet today requires high octane fuels. And yet the oil companies have supplied higher octane fuels at 100% of their stations. There are less than 10% of the vehicle fleet that are diesel passenger vehicles. And yet diesel is available at more than 50% of the gas stations across this country. Ethanol is 90 cents to a dollar cheaper than gasoline. Of course consumers want it. They need to have options. They want to lower their gasoline bill. And ethanol, higher ethanol blends, would allow them to do so. But the oil companies, particularly the big five, simply don't want to provide market access and are using every tool in their monopoly toolbox to deny consumers that lower cost option, to deny competition. I'm going to turn it over now to Jeff Cooper, who's going to talk a bit about how the oil companies manipulate the market, use those tools in their monopoly toolbox to deny consumer choice. Jeff?
Well, thanks, Bob, and thanks to everyone for joining us this afternoon. As Bob said, in the debate over the RFS and over the so-called ethanol blend wall, one of the oil industry's favorite arguments has been that they simply don't have any control over whether retail gas stations sell higher ethanol blends like E15 or E85 because they don't physically own many of those stations today. I believe the latest statistics show that the oil companies physically own something like less than 4 or 5% of the retail stations out there today. So in turn, they argue that they can't distribute the increasing volumes of renewable fuels that would be required by the RFS. So if you step back or if you peel back the onion, what you quickly see is that the major oil companies do, in fact, continue to exert tremendous control and influence over what fuel products are offered at retail stations. And they do this through highly restrictive franchise and branding agreements. They do this through highly prescriptive fuel supply contracts and a host of other subversive tactics that essentially prevent or at least significantly discourage retailers from selling greater volumes of renewable fuels. And this is particularly true for those stations that still carry a big oil company brand. And again, while the oil companies don't physically own many stations, more than half of the retail stations out there today carry the brand name and logo and signage of a major integrated oil company or a oil refining company. So we wanted to analyze the retail fuel market, which consists of about 150,000 retail gas stations today, to determine exactly who is selling E15 and E85 and who isn't. And this is what we found. We found that about 48,000, or about one-third of total stations out there today, carry the brand of one of the big five oil companies. So that would be ExxonMobil, Shell, BP, Chevron, and ConocoPhillips. So the brand of one of those five oil companies appears on about one-third of the retail stations in the U.S. today. Out of those stations, E85 or E15 is offered at far less than 1%. 0.6%, to be exact. And out of these stations, just one out of nearly 50,000 stations sells E15 today. So then you look at the other segments of the retail market, and you have about 22% of retail gas stations are branded by other oil refiners, that don't have upstream exploration or drilling assets. So you've got about 34,000 retail gas stations in this category, and they have a slightly higher proclivity to sell E85 or E15, but that's really just because there are two refiners in this category that far surpass the average. You have Cinex, CHS, and then the Speedway Super America brands, which are Marathon affiliated. Those two refining affiliated brands account for about half of the refiner branded stations selling E15 and E85. So if you take those two out, the other refiner branded stations, the rate at which they sell E85 or E15 is very comparable to the rate of the big five oil companies. So then when you look at the remaining roughly 74,000 retail stations out there that would be independently branded or not affiliated directly with an oil refining or integrated oil company brand, you have about 1,700 to 2,600, depending on which data set you use, 1,700 to 2,600 of those stations are selling E85 or E15. So, you know, what this all tells you is that unbranded or independently branded stations are about 4 to 6 times more likely to offer E85 and or E15 than a big five oil-branded retail station. So then you start to, you know, ask yourself, well, why is that? And this is where we really dug into the fuel supply contracts, the franchise agreements, and some of the other branding agreements that are out there. We were able to get our hands on a number of examples of such contracts and agreements. And what you find is there's a variety of methods that the oil companies use to shut out competition from renewable fuels. And a number of those examples are enumerated in the paper that we're releasing this afternoon. But just to provide a few examples, I mean, most of these fuel contracts require supplier exclusivity, meaning the retailer or the distributor to the retailer can only sell those fuels that are made available by the supplier. So if the supplier doesn't make E15 or E85 available at the terminal, then the distributor can't distribute it to the retailer. Oftentimes, these contracts will require minimum sales volumes of branded fuels. So if you're a retailer that might want to sell E85 or E15, you might jeopardize your ability to meet that minimum quota for branded gasoline products, which would be a violation of a franchise agreement. Other contracts require that multiple grades of branded gasoline be sold at all times. And that has the effect of eliminating or squeezing out the retailer's ability to store blends with more than 10% ethanol in many cases. If you're a retailer with two tanks and you're obligated to sell both regular gasoline and premium gasoline, you don't have any room for anything else. And so that's just one more example of how these contracts squeeze out renewable fuel options. Another requirement that we see frequently through franchise agreements is the requirement that retailers post, you know, intimidating warning labels in the event that they're even allowed to sell E85 or E15 fuels. You know, you'll often see labels that say this is not a ConocoPhillips product, for example, on the actual dispenser. And there are several other examples of kind of the strong arm tactics that appear in these contracts and franchise agreements, and those are described in detail in the paper. And there are several anecdotal examples from the marketplace in there. You know, one other one that I guess I would highlight is many of these branding agreements actively discourage retailers from promoting or even advertising the availability of E85. And we're aware of one case where a retail station was fined because it was advertising E85 prices in the top position of its price sign on the highway. It was fined for being in violation of its franchise agreement. So again, lots of examples in the paper of some of these tactics that are employed by the oil industry to control and influence what fuel products are offered to consumers. One other thing we did as part of this analysis that we plan to keep doing maybe on an annual basis is we put together what we called a consumer choice report card. And essentially what we did is we looked at the whole universe of retail gas station brands that are out there and looked at which of those branded chains are offering E15 or E85 and at what percentage of their stores. And if you're offering E15 or E85 at more than 25% of your branded stations, you get an A+, for example, in terms of offering consumer choice. If you're offering those fuels at 1% or less of your branded stations, that would qualify as an F. And what you see when you look at our report card is that the big five oil companies all received grades of F in terms of consumer choice. Many of the refiner branded stations received Fs. And in fact, there were only two refiner-affiliated brands that received marks of A or B, and that was, again, Speedway, which is a Marathon brand, and Cinex, the CHS brand. So those two are certainly exceptions to the rule when it comes to refining and oil branded stations. But on the bright side, there are a number of independent brands that are going out of their way to offer higher level blends and to offer greater consumer choice at the pump. Meyer Gas, for instance, offers E85 at roughly 60% of its retail gas stations, which was the highest out of the chains, the brands that we looked at. And there were, you know, Thornton's and Come and Go, MFA Break Time, Quick Trip, several other chains, branded chains, do offer consumer choice and are doing the right thing here. And I think serve as a great example of the type of consumer choice that we want to see in the marketplace. So that's included in the report, and we're happy to discuss the methodology behind that or any further details on that. But at this time, I'm going to turn it back over to Bob to discuss some of the priorities and I guess recommendations from a policy and marketing standpoint that come out of this report that we think would help alleviate this problem and break this monopoly. Bob?
Thanks, Jeff. Here's the bottom line. ExxonMobil, fail. Shell, fail. Chevron, fail. BP, fails. ConocoPhillips, fails. So what are we going to do about that? When the big oil companies are doing everything they can to keep a lower cost, high performance motor fuel from the American public, we've got to do something more. About a year ago, Senators Grassley and Klobuchar had written seeking a federal investigation into the anti-competitive practices. We outlined them in this paper. They talked about them in their letter, and yet this administration hasn't done anything. We need to incentivize FFVs. We need to invest in infrastructure. The industry is beginning to do that themselves, but These companies have to invest in their own infrastructure and make this happen. We have to enforce the Petroleum Marketers Practices Act and the Gas and Oil Competition Act that are clearly violated by the terms of many of these contracts. But the single most important thing that needs to be done is we have to enforce the renewable fuel standard. The RFS was the mechanism that was designed to break the monopolistic hold over the gas pump that the major oil companies have. If we back off from the RFS, we're rewarding those failing companies. This is not the time to be rewarding those companies that are exercising their market power to deny Americans choice at the pump. With that, maybe we can open it up for questions, if there are any.
Our first question comes from the line of Rachel Gantz with Oil Price Information Services.
Yes, hi. Recently, Senator Grassley had said he expects the final 2014 RFS rule to come out this fall. Do you agree?
I have no crystal ball that tells me when EPA is going to finalize the 2014 rule. My interest is that they get it right more than they get it fast, but everybody would benefit from some certainty, and I do hope that this administration acts quickly to restore the RFS volumes to those that will drive the kind of marketplace change that this.
The next question comes from the line of Amanda Peterker with Greenwire.
Hi. Just wondering in regard to the letters to the FTC requesting an investigation, have you heard anything back from the FTC or, I mean, even, you know, acknowledging that they've received the letter and are looking into it?
We did receive a response to the letter that we had sent more than a year ago now, outlining the experience of one marketer with Phillips 66 strong-arming that one company out of the E85 and E15 business. We got a response back. Frankly, it was somewhat perfunctory. Thank you for your letter. We'll look into it. A year later, they've done nothing, and that's pretty frustrating.
The next question comes from the line of Aisha Raskill with Reuters.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having this call. I was just wondering, I realize that that obviously the infrastructure for E15 isn't there, and this report is showing or is saying that the oil companies have basically been behind, not building out as they should to meet the RFS. But if the EPA were to raise the targets to, I guess, where they were federally mandated or the way it was laid out in the statute, the infrastructure wouldn't, you know, come overnight. So are you concerned at all that it would still take time, even if they put the targets in place, for the infrastructure to be built, and then there could be some pain that could be passed on to consumers in the time that it does take them for them to handle that build out? I guess is there any room for a middle ground on that? Maybe not necessarily going all the way out to where the statute says, but raising the target some from the proposal? Or I guess where do you guys stand on that?
Well, this is Bob. The infrastructure necessary for E15, it quite frankly, is relatively little and would not cost very much. That is, you know, far more a decision just not to allow franchisees to offer that product. So I think E15 could come on quickly if the decision were made to provide it to those consumers that would like to use it. E15 may be a little bit more challenging, but there are now many pumps available that are UL certified for E85 use, and I don't think it would take a great deal of time. But beyond all of that, you do have to remember that there are approximately 2 billion RINs. Jeff, correct me when I get the number wrong. that are out there that oil companies could use in the interim as well. We believe that the statutory volumes for the renewable fuel standard could be met through a combination of credits and increased E85 and E15 years. Jeff, did you want to add something?
Yeah, I mean, I think the only thing I would add is we have shown, and others have shown, Professor Bruce Babcock at Iowa State University is one example, you know, have shown that the FFVs and the infrastructure required to meet the 2014 statutory requirements, that's in place today. We have the ability today as we speak to distribute the volumes of renewable fuels that are called for in the statute for 2014. Now you get to 2015, and it gets to be a little more of a heavy lift. But if you send that signal today that we're going to enforce the 2014 volumes, then the market starts gearing up for those targets down the road, and the RIN mechanism begins to go to work and do what it was intended to do to help get the infrastructure out there and expand biofuels usage. So I think 2014 was certainly a jump, and 2015 and beyond, we need to put some more infrastructure in place. But the incentive to do that isn't there if we're not enforcing a robust RFS.
You have a question from the line of Cindy Zimmerman with DomesticFuel.com.
Hi, Bob and Jeff. Just wanted to tell you, Bob, that I asked Gina McCarthy today about when she expected that RFS rule to be released, and she said she hopes it'll be soon, but she said basically the same thing you did, that she wants to get it right. She wants to make sure she gets it right. But one of the other things she said was...
She probably said it with a better accent, though.
Oh, yeah. Why don't you have a Boston accent like her? Well, she also said that in going through one of the reasons, she explained the delay in that she said it's become clear that there's two concerns, not only about the volume of the fuels, but the way in which they're adjusting those volumes. I didn't quite understand that. I wonder if you, Jeff, could explain that.
At the risk of trying to interpret the administrator, I suspect what she was referring to is the mechanism by which they will adjust it. In other words, they relied upon statutory authority that they believe is there to reduce the overall RFS based on the blend wall. Well, the blend wall is a demand constraint, and the waiver authority they were citing is really only about available supply. And we had maintained in our comments to the agency that conflating supply and demand and reading the blend wall into the statute simply could not be done legally. And so perhaps they have in fact reread the statute, and they have acknowledged that they cannot introduce a consumption or a demand factor into an exclusively supply-oriented waiver. So the fact that they are, trying to think about that is, refreshing.
Your next question comes from the line of Tom Waterman, Ethanol Monitor.
I have a question about flex fuel vehicles. I recently read, that the General Motors CEO said the total cost is about $70 additional in the manufacturing cost to create a flex fuel vehicle. I'm wondering if there's any political movement to try to do that. I mean, it kind of makes sense to just, why wouldn't you just have every vehicle flex fuel capable?
Well, we have supported in the past legislation that would not have required FFVs, but would have required that automakers make something other than gasoline-only vehicles, whether they were natural gasoline vehicles or electric vehicles or flex-fuel vehicles for biofuels. And that legislation had some life a couple of years ago. There's been very little movement on it of late, but we do think that something like that makes a lot of sense. EPA can help the situation significantly simply by properly scoring from a greenhouse gas, the FFVs, and giving automakers a regulatory incentive to produce those vehicles. And, Jeff, I don't know if you want to put a finer point on that or not, but that would be one thing that EPA could do that would be extraordinarily helpful.
Yeah, I guess I would only add to that that in previous iterations of the fuel economy standards, automakers did receive credit toward compliance with those requirements when they built flex fuel vehicles. The impending fuel economy and tailpipe emissions regulations that begin in 2017 really remove that incentive, really in favor of incentivizing electric vehicles. And so, yeah, I mean, certainly if EPA restored a meaningful FFE credit as part of the CAFE regulations, that would go a long way in helping ensure that we're producing and driving more FFEs.
The next question comes from the line of Elliot Blackburn with Argus Media.
Good afternoon. I was just curious, will you guys ask for FTC to look at this again, or how do you press forward on this request for investigation and enforcing the laws that are in place?
Well, we will certainly do that, whether it's by letter or just by continuing a dialogue with them. But quite frankly, they've not shown much enthusiasm for going after the oil companies on this issue, and I can't understand why, because the benefit to consumers would be significant. It would seem that the administration would want to, but so far, I guess they've had other priorities.
The next question comes from the line of Spencer Chase with our great Pulse.
Oh, yeah, thank you for taking my call. I guess my question is, it's probably only a matter of time before there's some kind of rebuttal from oil companies on this issue, and then you guys will probably end up rebutting their rebuttal. What's it going to take for a meaningful conversation of sorts to happen between the two entities and to really get this issue resolved?
Well, we thought we had it resolved when the 2007 energy bill was passed, and there was a very clear pathway to growing this market that most definitely led to more than 10% blends being used. The auto companies responded to that legislation by dramatically increasing their production of flex-fueled vehicles. The ethanol industry and the advanced biofuels industry certainly responded by expanding production, and you see the commercialization of cellulosic ethanol happening today, so we stepped up. The only stakeholder that has resisted has been the oil companies. And, we think that if you simply enforce the renewable fuel standard, it will compel the oil companies to make more than 10% fuels available to those consumers that want to use them. That's all. And I look forward to the rebuttal.
And there are no further questions at this time.
All right. Well, thank you again, all of you, for being on the call. If you have any further questions, feel free to give us a call at the Renewable Fuels Association. We think this report stands for itself, and we look forward to future years when some of those F students get some remedial inspiration, and we can move them all up to A's, and the American consumer will benefit. Thank you all. Thank you, Bernard.